Matt, and welcome to our podcast series Takeout with Ashley Coff RD and Robin O'Brien, discussing better nutrition simplified in the new food economy. Today we have special guest Matthew Dillon on the show. Matthew is Director of Agricultural Policy and Programs at Clif Bar & Company, a leading maker of nutritious and organic foods and drinks for people on the go, just like you. Right, let's get this podcast started. Over to you, ladies.
Well, today we are super excited to have Matthew Dillon, the Director of Agricultural Policy and Programs at Clif Bar, joining us. I've known Matthew for a few years now, and I truly believe that he is probably one of the most valuable resources when it comes to our food system today. His experience is incredible. He was the founding director of Organic Seed Alliance, and I think to truly understand what's happening to the health of our families and what's happening to the health of our food system, you have to understand what's happening at that level. And the depth of his knowledge, his insight is awesome. It is totally inspiring. He's like an encyclopedia. And so Ashley and I are just thrilled to have him on the show today. Matthew, thank you so much for being part of this.
I'm really grateful to be here. Thank you, Robin and Ashley, for inviting us.
So, you know, I kind of want to go back a little bit because I think for so many people who are sort of coming into the food movement today, there's usually some kind of trigger. You know, for me, it was food allergies in one of my kids. For somebody else, it may be a cancer diagnosis. For somebody else, they may just decide that they're fed up and they want to start a small farm or maybe, you know, start to raise their own chickens. For you, what was it? You've been involved for so long, but in the early years of your work, what was that initial trigger that brought you into the food movement?
Well, sometimes I think in life, it takes a reminder of an initial epiphany to really get moving in the right direction. So for me, there were really a twofold experience. The first experience in my life that I think informed the direction I've gone in food and farming was that I grew up in a conventional farming family in eastern Nebraska, a very small town called Gretna, Nebraska, between Omaha and Lincoln. And one of my first jobs was walking soybean fields in the summertime, weeding them with a machete. Crews of, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13-year-old kids would go out and weed these fields in August. And I was doing it one summer. I was 12 years old. And while weeding a field, we finished one soybean field and needed to move to another. And we decided to take a shortcut through a cornfield. And we probably shouldn't have taken a shortcut through a cornfield. The farmer wouldn't have been happy because we could have disturbed his plants, but we were kids and we didn't want to walk around. It was a hot August day. And so we cut through, and cutting through the field, we were in the hidden, and a spray, cropper, flew over the field and sprayed, a pesticide on that cornfield. And I got very sick, very, very sick. I lost 15 pounds in about 5 days.
It was immediate that you got that sick, yeah?
Within a week.
Okay.
And was put into the hospital, and for multiple days they did a whole battery of tests to try to figure out what happened. We did not go in and say, I've been sprayed with a pesticide. My parents just thought I was sick and had, you know, was losing weight and couldn't understand why I was losing weight and had no appetite and was just feeling, you know, awful. And they weren't sure, and hadn't thought about it really either. I mean, I was miserable. So they tested me for a variety of things and didn't really ever come up with anything very conclusive. But a few years later, when I had stopped growing, I was one of the tallest kids in my class in sixth grade. I was 5 foot three, weighed about 100 pounds before I lost the weight, 105 pounds. And I stopped growing. And when I suddenly, I didn't grow for several years. My parents took me to the doctor again, and we went back in my medical history, and the doctor asked about that incident, and that was kind of the first aha. I mean, the first doctor who said, well, I think there was potentially an endocrine disruption from exposure to pesticides. Well, I was exposed to pesticides all the time. My dad sold agricultural pesticides. I helped him move the boxes. I was in outbuildings that, you know, where there was leakages of these pesticides on a regular basis. So when he said that, it wasn't exactly an aha. It was, well, of course, I've been exposed. And that incident came back to me many years later when my dad had died of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, cancer that's very much related to agricultural exposure of pesticides. And in trying, I was 23, and trying to kind of figure out what to do with my father's death and the absence of him in my life, I reflected on what he loved the most. And what he really loved the most was gardening. It was not big scale agriculture, but was growing. We had about a 3-acre vegetable garden that we grew vegetables not only for ourselves and our extended family, but sold vegetables door to door, sweet corn and tomatoes. And my dad loved that. And it got me thinking just about my life in ag, and it brought back that experience of being exposed to pesticides. And I became curious about what really were the impacts of conventional chemical agriculture on others. And that set me on my way.
Wow, that is an incredibly profound story. I had no idea that you had had that experience. I think you literally are a walking encyclopedia of this movement in a very personal way too. And I think one of the things that has always struck me about you is you do have this very acute focus and deep knowledge on the pesticides. And I think it's something that really is only just coming to light today. Thankfully, last year, you know, the World Health Organization issued the statement that glyphosate, which is this key ingredient in Roundup, is a probable carcinogen. And that was just a game-changing announcement, I think, in so many ways. And I think it's something that's really intuitive as a parent. I mean, I know I say all the time, you know, we're told not to keep that stuff under our kitchen sinks. We're told to keep it out of the reach of children. It says it on the bottle. And yet at the same time, this is the stuff that's being routinely applied to our food and across, you know, all of these farms. And I think it's really, really hard for somebody whose livelihood depends on farming to be able to absorb this information. And I say that from a really personal place because I'm actually named after a farmer. And like your family, you know, her heart, she's incredible. I mean, her love and the generosity that comes out of a farming family, I think, are incredible. But at the same time, she had a child that had cancer in one of her legs, and then she herself battled breast cancer. And so she was very compartmentalized in what she had to do as a farmer to earn her income versus trying to understand what this stuff may be doing to her family. And so I'm wondering, as you came into this awareness, and I think for so many of us, you know, as we come into this knowledge and come into this awareness, it can create a bit of a personal challenge with people that are really close to us and with families, especially, I think, between generations. You know, as you began to shift in this mindset agriculturally, how was that received by your family?
Well, interestingly, my family completely got out of agriculture. My grandfather, my father, my grandfather, my uncle ran the main farm. My dad had an agrochemical and agricultural animal supply business. They did not want me to enter into agriculture. They saw it as a dying profession, not specifically because of the chemicals, but because of policies. My grandfather was very upset with Earl Butz, the Secretary of Agriculture, a proclamation that farmers needed to get big or get out. And my grandfather also felt affronted that, you know, food and his crops were being used as political weapons, and he was being paid to not grow crops, and didn't like the subsidy game as it was developing in the 70s. And so he felt it was not a viable economic endeavor for the next generations. My parents actually did not have a lot of money. They scraped and they saved, and they decided to put me into boarding school because they didn't want me to go into agriculture. But my boarding school, Elkhorn Mount Michael, Elkhorn, Nebraska, it was a Benedictine monastery, had an organic farm. And so while they wanted me to get away from agriculture, that exposure to an organic farm definitely influenced my ending up in ag. So, you know, to answer your question, with my direct family, it wasn't a big challenge, but I come from conventional agricultural roots, and I care about farmers of all stripes. And so it is a challenge for me, and I think for the organic movement as a whole, to talk about the negative impacts and the challenges of conventional chemical agriculture without creating a culture war and without scaring farmers away from organic, because we need more conventional farmers to transition. And it's tough to get them to transition if we're, you know, rubbing their nose in their chemicals and saying, oh, what a bad boy you are for using these chemicals.
Right. I think it also sets up this like really difficult dynamic, which, you know, I know Robin has seen many times, and I see 1,000 times within my sphere from dietitians and physicians, et cetera, when, you know, ever I'm talking about this either in the media or in social media, and people come back and say, oh, like you hate farmers, you know, or you're so anti-science, or, you know, and even I've tried, I remember hearing Maria Rodale at one point, and I've tried like not calling it conventional farming because I try to just communicate, you know, here's what organic farming is, and then there's a way of farming that is not farming that way, and it's using, you know, a lot of chemicals. And, you know, part of the conversation is it's really become this, like, organic is one, in people's mind, I think it's been almost a mismarketing on both sides, and people tend to feel that that organic is 100% or it's so pristine or there are no chemicals associated. So when they hear that there are some chemicals that are approved or some things that can be involved, they start to feel like, oh, well, organic isn't safe. And on the flip side, you know, my belief is that there are instances and ways, and I may be wrong, I'm not the farmer in this situation, but where you can use some of these chemicals, but not in the way that we've been using them, to the scale that we've been using them, or that there may be swaps that could be less harmful, but that would still be not approved in organic, but that would still be, you know, better both from an environmental and a health standpoint. I guess it's like, how do we bring people to that space so that it feels less about the perfect organic being this promise of perfect, which will never succeed, and it, you know, and really help people understand what the alarm is, as you were saying, like something that can just get kids sick from, you know, multiple exposures, but even from one massive exposure.
Well, I think you're spot on that both sides have a role in this. That unfortunately, the conversation is too often dominated by marketing departments as opposed by really bringing some agricultural literacy and, in my case, oftentimes seed literacy into the discussion. And, you know, I do work for an organic food company, Clif Bar & Company sells, and we have 16 different certified organic product lines. And so, you know, it's tough. You know, I don't want to say that food companies can't have a role in the conversation. They can, but the conversation has to be much broader than food companies. And one of the corners that the organic trade and the sector as a whole has painted itself into is creating this myth early in our development that organic was farming like grandma and grandpa used to. And it was this idealized, because, you know, wonderful farm with the cows all out in pasture and, you know, the barn always painted and the fields always green. And it can backfire, and I think it has backfired to some degree. And I think we all recognize that now in the sector. It's not, there's no one company or, you know, we as trade collectively really need to own that mythology in marketing has works only so far. And we have a public that wants transparency and they want more information. And we also are undervaluing and underserving organic by not pointing out that it's innovation and best scientific practices and a complex understanding of ecological interactions. So
there's such a huge opportunity right now to bring all of the stakeholders to the table. And I think, you know, hearing the story about your own family deciding that it wasn't in their child's best interest to go into farming, there is so much heartache in that. And I think it's a complete function of the way that we have financially structured the farming system. And I think about the fact that none of us would get very far in our day without our food, and yet we haven't valued the career of farmers in a way that reflects that. You know, we value the careers of a lot of other people, but, you know, if you think about the fundamental importance of farming families to our economy, they're not valued that way. And so, you know, I say, I mean, this is a lifetime of work for me because we need to refinance the food system. And I think that begins with valuing the profession of farmers. I've flown out to Iowa, I've been sitting on a plane next to a young guy who said he's not going into it. He can't support his family. And there's so much heartache in that. And at the same time, you know, sitting in meetings with, I was invited out to a Syngenta operation and I went out, they were pretty snarky when I walked in the door, you know, and then I sat down with him and I said, your family's been feeding our country for 4 or 5 generations. We wouldn't even be here today if it weren't for that. And I think somewhere in the story, we forgot that. And now to work with those farmers who, you know, because of the financial situation are opting into this really chemically intensive operating system when it comes to their farms. But if financials were sort of at a neutral place, they wouldn't. And I think, again, like that's, there's heartache in that where it's like they're farming in a way that is not consistent with their values. And to me, the voices that we truly need to have at the table are those of the farmers. And I, you know, I'm the same with this organic thing where it's like, you look at the numbers in organic, it's less than 1% of our agricultural land is under organic management. So how are we going to grow this industry? You know, if it's growing at 14% a year, where is that going to come from? And right now, it's coming out of Australia or China or Romania, these other countries, because we don't have the supply chain. So, yeah. You know, to really, I think about any other industry, if this were tech, if this were auto, if this were aerospace, you know, people would be all over trying to change those economics. And well, as you spoke to, you know, we've got this policy problem.
Yeah. But you're right. People would be rushing to solve this, especially because it's more profitable, I was going to say, than conventional farming. It's more profitable for the farmers. It's more economically robust for rural communities. It has less of an economic cost associated with the health implications from chemical agriculture. You know, the farm workers getting sick from these chemicals. In states like California, that's a serious mm-hmm. amount of hidden subsidies that we're paying for migrant farm workers' health, as we should as a country. But the people who should be paying for it are the companies using those chemicals in those fields or those workers are working. So yes, there's in any other industry, we'd be rushing to solve this and we would be looking at policy and what policy incentives and disincentives are supporting a broken system and what we need to incentivize a healthier system. That is a big challenge, but there have been some positive been some positive work in the last farm bill and hopefully uh-huh. in the upcoming farm bill that can change that. But it is the long game.
It's so fascinating. So your experience with your family, so I grew up in a family of physicians and there it was like, no, you don't need to go that route. You know, like my brother almost has like put a case together when he decided, we were both history majors, and when he decided to go back to medicine to become a doctor, he's like, I'm going to show you, Dad, how I'll be able to do this, you know, that kind of a thing. And so it's so interesting, like when we look at total health and we look at what's going on with farmers and our food supply and we look at what's going on in healthcare and our physicians and that space. And, you know, and Robin, when you talk about people working against their beliefs or, you know, they feel just, you know, there are a lot of doctors that don't want to, they would prefer to be able to get reimbursed for preventive healthcare and they know they get reimbursed for treatment, you know, and so, or disease management. So it's pretty fascinating. I want to go to something I think at the core of both of them, and it sounds like you're the person, but this concept of seeds, I think, is so fascinating. You know, obviously, and our listeners are a very savvy group, you know, there's a whole conversation about genetic modification and seeds. But I remember being down in Costa Rica, actually, at a farm I was talking to Tom Newmark about Savor Seeds, and we were talking about seeds as really being languages or just as being part of, you know, maintaining the magical diversity that, that influences or, you know, optimizes the potential of our world, you know, to not be small on it. And I think it's pretty fascinating because to me, I see so many of the problems, like obviously the application of these chemicals is really challenging, but talk a little bit about what has happened to seeds. And I would love to know more about what your work has been in that space. Because as far as I've understood it, it's that we've almost been creating this mono seed society as well, which is, you know, from a nutritional standpoint has application, but also doesn't help from a farming standpoint when you have, you know, the environmental diversity, et cetera.
Yeah, happily. And we should probably spend a little time on the nutritional aspect of plant breeding as well.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just give a brief overview on, you know, really the state of seed. And that's that really the history of the United States with seed has been primarily one of seed as a public resource that our public institutions, the USDA, land-grant universities, initially invested serious amounts of money to try to improve our crop genetic diversity and expand that diversity to farmers across the country, because we were a nation of farmers. And so it was the largest investment the USDA made was in its seed program. And we bred and developed an incredible amount of diverse species and introduced diverse species to this continent that really did help feed a fast-growing country. If you fast forward to the end of World War II, the agrochemical companies were starting to grow out of the military-industrial complex of World War II, and they saw ag as a great opportunity to keep selling their product in a time without war. So they not only looked at packaging more of these chemical cocktails to farmers, but how plant breeding could also be a part of the solution. And so we began a slow process of breeding crops that were chemically dependent, that were dependent upon chemical coatings to protect them against early disease and emergence and germination, that were dependent on chemical sprays once they did emerge and throughout their lifetime. And that certainly came to their kind of crowning fruition in crops being genetically engineered to withstand even greater applications of herbicides. So while that scientific component was occurring, there was also a massive consolidation and concentration in the seed industry that was propped up by the use of utility patents that allowed for large players who'd never been involved in seed before, companies like DuPont, Dow, Monsanto, Syngenta, Novartis, all agrochemical or pharmaceutical companies who'd not been involved with seed in the 80s or even the early 90s, who suddenly rush into the seed world and begin buying up companies, independent companies, and even some concentrated companies across the globe. What that really has led to is a lack of research and investment in plant breeding for sustainable agriculture and organic agriculture. And by sustainable, I mean true sustainable agriculture that is looking at how do we enhance the quality of our natural resources season after season instead of just extract value from those resources. And so when organic came into real fruition as a federal program, we had no seed infrastructure, we had minimal seed infrastructure to support it. And as demand has grown and acreage has grown, and as you all pointed out, acreage hasn't grown enough to keep up with demand, seed has grown even at a slower pace. We really lack the organic seed infrastructure that we need to deliver farmers varieties that do well in specific organic conditions. You know, you breed a seed for the environment of intended use, and an organic environment is very different than a conventional, from the way it gets fertility to the weed management to biological diversity in the field. So we're at a time where we really need to invest in organic seed systems, both in the industry of organic seed as well as in public sector research and development to improve seed. And that's what I'm doing. One of the things I'm doing with Cliff Bar and Cliff Bar Family Foundation right now is running the Seed Matters Initiative for the foundation that aims to improve organic seed, and also an endowment program and some other research programs for the company that are about improving our public seed and doing it in a very different way. I mean, we're doing this research as a company and investing in this as a company and foundation in the public good, in the public domain. These investments we're making are not about creating proprietary varieties or proprietary research that we as a company own, but instead about serving a broader public good of regional farming systems.
So listening to you, I'm thinking of a meeting I was in last week, and it was with one of the companies that provide school lunches, you know, and I mean, you talk about somebody that just gets pummeled all the time. And, you know, here they are, they're trying to create better food, you know, in cafeterias for kids on a budget that is just insane to try to build anything like that around. And so, you know, what kept coming up was education. You know, how do we educate people and how do we teach people about the true value of food and the importance of this nutrition and how to cook? You know, if the mom doesn't know how to cook, then the kid's not learning either. And we talked about how here in the United States, a parallel is in technology and how, you know, as a country, we weren't taught how to code, and that, you know, around the world, that's a language that kids are learning in school is coding. And so, you know, I look at food as a language that we as a country need to learn. We need to learn the vocabulary. We need to learn how it fits together. And I think about the seed opportunity. You know, I keep coming back to this concept of how do we teach food? How do we teach food economics in school? And it seems like it's such a critical part of our national security is to have a healthy, robust, secure food system that obviously starts with the soil and the seed. And so I look at the opportunity just the way the team that did code.org came together and sort of said, fine, if it's not in the system right now, we're going to be this kind of roving educational unit that can snap into any school anywhere. And I think there's a huge opportunity for something like that when it comes to food education too.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, I think that's one of the things I've seen recently is that the conventional chemical biotech side is doing a better job than we are
in
schools through STEM, technology, engineering, mathematic programs that are about attracting youth to those kind of science, tech, engineering, math related professions. And their curriculum does not represent our scientific approach and ecological approach to food and farming. So it is a gap. And I think that you're bringing up, we've talked about a lot of gaps here. And I think I just want to say one thing about that. We as a sector have a responsibility. Organic food companies, organic consumers, organic farmers, we all have this responsibility to leave our natural resources better than the way we got them. And one of the natural resources that's not often talked about, we have soil, we have seed, we have water. All those are very important resources. But human knowledge is also a resource. And we have to make investments in the human knowledge resource if we do want to improve it and leave the next generation better off. And why do we have so many gaps? There's a lot of reasons. I don't want to blame it on one thing, but I do have to say this. And Robin, I know you and I both have worked in the bringing education and awareness to GMO and GMO issues for a long time. And I've been involved in lawsuits against Monsanto and the USDA and you name it. So I'm with the fight against GMOs, totally with it. I think we're imbalanced in our portfolio. I think the organic sector has spent so much money fighting GMOs and fighting for labeling. I wish we could go back in time and find another group of donors besides organic food companies to fund that fight, because that million, tens and tens of millions of dollars also was needed in all of these other areas. And I think we have to look at priorities and say, what is the opportunity cost of over-focusing on the GMO issue and not focusing on these longer-term research issues that organic farmers need, seed just being one of them, education of the next generation, because money is a resource and it is not endless. And so we do have some tough decisions that we're going to have to make. Hopefully the GMO fight, we're going to win on labeling here soon and things will free up a bit. But I just want to point out that that's something I think we have to take some time and reflect on and make sure we're not neglecting other priorities as we do take care and are diligent on the GMO issue.
I totally agree. And I think, it's a function of what kind of energy, do people want to give to a movement. And if you're fighting something, that's a really negative energy. It's not expansive. And I think if you are growing something, that's such a contagious, passionate, fun, energetic energy, that you can be part of. And I totally agree. And I think if you look at, it's why I'm always talking numbers, because I just think there's no emotion in it. There's just no emotion. And when you look at the fact that Organic Valley just hit $1 billion in sales, it's the first organic food company to do that back in December of 2015, that's huge. And that sends a huge message. And I think to really say, this is a really exciting opportunity for our country. And the thing that totally gets me is that we're outsourcing this opportunity right now to all these other countries. Because you talk to Applegate, and I asked them, I said, I grew up in Texas. Like, I know how they're making the meat down there. Where are you guys getting all this clean meat? And they said, well, we have to go to Australia and we have to go to Uruguay. And I'm like, that's crazy. Why aren't we connecting with Texas cattlemen? And I know not all of them are going to be ready for this, that the belief systems can run really deep, but for the ones that maybe do want to start embracing this, should we open up these conversations? And to me, again, I just look at it as an industry, and if there were any other industry, policy would be supporting expansion and supporting growth. And I think that's why I think your work is so heroic, because the work that still needs to be done on the policy front is huge. And, it is
an economic case. We have to make the economic case even more clear than we have already to our legislators and our policymakers that that organic is this incredible opportunity for rural America, and that we are losing that opportunity right now. We are getting beat by other countries. And the cost is not only this lost opportunity of enhancement, but it's also this continued subsidization of a broken program. It's this $5 billion a year that we give to corn alone in crop subsidies now in the form of crop insurance, for baseline payments in corn. And that $5 billion reinvested in organic and helping more transition farmers to organic meet our consumer demand would have incredible ripple effect of adding value throughout not only the food sector, but really more importantly to me, rural communities. I mean, that's all of our policies should be asking the question of how does this impact farm workers, farm owners, and rural communities? Every policy. That's the first three questions.
Absolutely. And I mean, just that number of $5 billion, that is mind-blowing because that is bigger than the FDA's annual budget.
Yeah. And here's the thing I want to point out about the farm workers is that, you know, we often think about we eat organic food because it's good for ourselves and our families and all that. The question should be, is this food good for farm workers? Because I can guarantee you, if the food you're eating is good for farm workers, that is, it doesn't cause cancer, respiratory disease, developmental disorders in their children, if the farm workers who are actually doing the in-the-field work of growing our food are benefiting from growing that food and not experiencing negative health consequences from it,
right,
that food is going to be better for your family. Period.
Yeah. And, you know, I did my internship and residency at County Hospital in LA. And so, you know, we really saw people, I mean, you saw that many people's medical care was really emergency care. And this, you're absolutely right. You know, we were seeing people at the time who didn't have health care. So a lot has changed in that space. And we won't get into the issues of, you know, the whole immigration thing and that piece. But I think you're raising a really important point because so much of the drain on, from a financial standpoint and economic standpoint, societally, is on people who their health, you know, it's just like chicken and egg. Like we want them to do this work so that we can have the food for our families. But if we make their families unhealthy, we're negatively impacting our country's, you know, financial health. So it's this, you know, this whole piece is so challenging. Yeah.
Yeah. What we do to the planet, we do to ourselves. So
right.
We do to the planet on the farm level, we very directly do to those farm workers, and we're responsible for that. But then broader speaking, like we do it to ourselves. These chemicals are persistent and they stay in our environment, as we have learned from DDT being found in the breast milk of you know, women living north of the Arctic Circle. What we do to the planet, we do to ourselves. And that really to me is, I don't know what the marketing of that is in the organic sector, but I feel like that message needs to go deeper, that this is not just a choice about the net tally of the nutritional benefits of your food at any given moment, but rather about the production system and what it is doing to the planet, because what it is doing, you are doing to yourself. You're either
Yeah, it's that, you know, that integral link. To that end, when we talk about what you're doing, when we think about yourself and your community and your village, and then we think about the country, I wanted to jump into, we have a list of questions that we ask every guest because it helps. Some of them are a little bit more intense on the thought side, and a couple of them are hopefully a way to really have some fun. But it helps us to also show people what you've done. And, you know, there is so much to your point of, you know, what decisions that you're making. And as we heard from the beginning, this really comes from a very personal standpoint for you. So I'd love to dive into those. And really just first thing, you know, we haven't sent these over to you. So, you know, first things that come to mind. So the first question that we have is, what is the greatest obstacle that you've overcome?
Well, I'll give you the professional
sure.
Mm-hmm. I've overcome that also ties into personal. And that is, as you all noted at the beginning, I founded Organic Seed Alliance with my friend John Navazio and was founding director for many years. And my decision to leave Organic Seed Alliance and to come, you know, eventually work for Cliff Bar Family Foundation and then the company was one of the greatest challenges I've had to overcome. And I'd say the obstacle was my own ego. And that is, I felt ownership of this nonprofit that I had helped to create, even though I knew it was a public nonprofit. And yet I also knew that it needed a new iteration, a new generation of leadership and of thinkers and actors in the organization, and that I needed to make room for them and some of the staff that I had hired. And so it's always tough to I think for many nonprofit leaders to step down from their really their baby and to leave their baby and move.
Yeah, you know who has the best word for that? Her name is Nancy Chuda. She was the founder of Healthy Child, and she calls it founderitis.
Yes, totally.
It's really common.
Yeah. If you love someone, let them free, right? It's like you gotta watch it grow. Fantastic.
That was a big obstacle, one, leaving it, and then two, this obstacle of, oh my God, I've always been self-employed or been the leader of a nonprofit or farmer or whatever, and I'm going to go work for a food company, a corporation.
Right. I have to get dressed and go to work every day.
Well, and what does it mean for, like, what does it mean for me in terms of,
right.
I don't change easily. I'm very, my values are my values, and I'm not going to change it for anyone or any price. So it's been, it was an obstacle in the setup of it, but luckily, I have found Cliff Bridges to be incredible to work for, and that Gary Erickson, Kit Crawford, the co-owners, along with all the employees here, have been incredibly supportive of the same type of work I was doing in the nonprofit sector, but with some of the power and finances and ability of a company behind. And I'm grateful for that, and I'm grateful that obstacle kind of has dissolved, as it were, and I feel more energized than I ever have in the food movement.
Great.
Yeah,
so speaking of that,
as an outsider, I do. It does seem like you've taken your message and attached it to this very powerful vehicle, and it feels really sincere and true. So, I mean, I'm so grateful that you did have the courage to make that change.
Thank you.
So that's like the icing on the obstacle overcometh cake. That one, you've definitely overcome it. So congratulations. And when we think, looking at the positive side, when we think about where people can get engaged and what can change, what do you see as the greatest opportunity that you see in this movement? And this movement being, you know, food, health, where we need to go.
Well, I think the opportunity is we're in it. I think people are learning more about their food system and farming and while we still have literacy issues, as we've talked about today, it's pretty incredible that we're addressing them. And one of the key opportunities I see is for the urban and backyard food movement. I mean, we forget that food is not just produced by companies or farmers, but it's grown by individuals. And that's a key important part of food production. And I think the rise of student farms on campuses, of urban farms that are cooperative, rooftop gardens, that's going to continue to expand.
Mm-hmm.
And we should be designing our in our town, more of that in mind. I think it's a great opportunity, even in Africa, as it becomes more urbanized, that we should be designing those urban centers with food production built into the urban centers. That's a lost opportunity if we as an international community don't help fund and influence that now.
Yeah, I'm feeling that acutely because I was telling Robin earlier that post Jonas Blizzard, we have zero produce even in the frozen section, like at the grocery store. There's just none, you know, that's here. And it's crazy. There are tons of farms around, and I'm sure there is access to food. It's just that we haven't had we have stores that are waiting for the big shipments to come in. Interesting. Food for thought, certainly. Okay, so a little bit of a different one, thinking of very personal for you, but who inspires you and why?
I mean, a lot of people. I feel like I'm surrounded by inspirational people. I'm really just...
That's lucky. Good.
lucky to have so many folks around me, but I think the person who, I think about the most that's inspirational is an organic farmer turned plant breeder named Frank Morton. A salad mix grower who taught himself how to save seed and then how to breed seed on his own and created Wild Garden Seed that now his seeds are bought by lots of big vegetable companies and resold and repackaged. And he's a hero to me because not only has he been successful at this enterprise and really bootstrapped and taught himself genetics and plant breeding, but the main reason is that he gives away his creations. That is, he does sell seed, but he does not patent or demand royalties or prevent seed saving or prevent other plant breeders from continuing to breed and riff off of his material.
Mm-hmm.
So he really is, if you think about the industrial seed and food system being this closed fist, control, hidden, bash your competitors with the closed fist and hide your secrets, Frank is this open hand who's sharing and embracing and networking and giving away all of this passion and knowledge, because he doesn't see it as property. He sees it as, you know, our common good. And he is, for so many years, been my hero for that alone, as well as that he makes an incredible product.
Awesome. So we would love to, and separate from this, he is somebody I would love to talk to, and I'm sure that our listeners
totally.
Would.
So totally,
can you, I think Rob and I are both like, we got to get him. So please, first of all, we will tell him that you, I'm sure he has an inkling, but we, you know, thank you for that, because we would love to learn more about his work and share his story. Yeah.
The visual of the closed fist versus the open hand. I think
yeah.
those two visuals absolutely personify the two different systems.
Yeah, no, incredible.
At a really deep, you know, iconic level, he is Seed, in that, you know, Seed wants to diversify and change. It wants to multiply, and it wants to disseminate freely. It wants to travel on birds and animals and through the wind. And so he is that representation of that freedom and that diversity and multiplicity that is Seed. And I find him such a beautiful human being for that reason.
Awesome. Thank you. I think we're both like giddy. Like, this is so exciting. Okay. So this one, if you were a food, what food would you be and why?
I'm glad you asked food instead of vegetable. I've been asked a vegetable before and it always stumped me, but food is actually a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. I would be a meal prepared by my grandma Rose Colada and my grandpa Giuseppe Colada. A meal that I don't really eat very much anymore, which would be homemade spaghetti with homemade zugu and homemade zizzita, you know, sauce, Italian sausage from my Sicilian grandparents. And I would be that because those meals were the most passionate and memorable. They were about relationship and deep connection. And to me, that's what food is about. It's about relationship. And that was my first real joy and love of food, as well as of the conversations around the dinner table, was being at my grandma and grandpa's table. So I'd be a meal.
Wow. Moving from, so I can like taste the meal and my mouth is watering, to a question that does not leave us mouth watering, but I can't wait for your answer on, which is, what one message would you send to the current Congress?
I would want to send the message politely, because I don't think sending a message.
No, don't be polite. No, I'm just kidding.
I think the message would be this, that we can have a economically successful agricultural sector and food sector and still care for our natural resources, our planet, and the people who grow our food. And that while it's frightening to think about dismantling the current subsidized system and creating causing the industry that supports it to go through changes, it can be done, and it must be done if long-term we're going to address all of the challenges we face in populations and in resource depletion. And we have a roadmap.
You know, listening to you talk, there's so many parallels that I continue to hear with the climate change movement. And I think about, you know, like our system where it's so heavily subsidized with oil. You know, you sort of have these two systems, and, you know, how do we hedge our bets at this point? You know, and I just thought that continued, but I just keep thinking, what can we be learning here from the climate change movement? These same lessons, how can we apply them here? And what can we learn from the mistakes of the climate change movement so that we can move quickly here, you know, so that we can embrace this system that's going to work for the 21st century. And it's not that we intentionally created a system that was going to fail, but, you know, we're realizing that there are a lot of shortcomings in the system that we've inherited. So how do we create a better system? And I keep seeing the parallels between, you know, the oil industry and now as we try to shift, you know, to different alternative energy systems. It continues to strike me as I listen to you talk.
Well, you said something important, hedge your bets. I mean, we have to diversify our investments, not, you know, it's one of those things, if you are lucky enough to have money to invest at the end of the day, you don't want to just buy one stock. You want to be able to diversify. And it's, when you think about agricultural research and policies, they are the long-term investments in our farming and food systems. And we need to diversify it. We have too many eggs in one biotech basket and conventional chemical basket, and we have to diversify. That's the message I would probably want to send, actually, is diversify the investment and increase investment in organic agriculture and in healthy foods.
Absolutely. I mean, it just makes sense economically. It makes sense, you know, in the global marketplace. It absolutely makes sense. So here's our last question. And this is something that I think about every day. You know, I kind of hold on to this vision of the story that I want to be able to tell my grandchildren. So the question is, it's 2050. How does this story play out?
Interesting. So I truly believe, and I see signs of it already, that some of the learnings we're getting from organic agriculture, and as we dive deeper into our understanding of how organic works, some of those learnings by 2050 will be applied more and more by the conventional sector. They'll be applied because they'll see the advantage of it from a resource perspective, from an economic perspective, and also because of pressures from the marketplace. And so we'll see more conventional ag aligned, I guess, with organic practices, you know, doing crop rotations and potentially diversifying cropping systems. It won't be a perfect fix. It will not be organic, but it'll look more like organic. Organic will have had that much influence, and it's happening already to some degree. I believe that's one of the main things we'll see by 2050 is that organic will have not only grown in its market share and percentage of acres, but we will have been a positive influencer, even if we don't get credit, on the conventional chemical agricultural system.
Wow.
That's a great goal. I love it.
I like your 2050, sir.
Yes.
I've seen it already. I mean, I won't name names, but well, I was a brief period when I was an independent consultant, I was hired by a large conventional processed vegetable company to help them go organic. And while they never really were very successful with their organic lines, they did contact me years later in an email and say, hey, you know, we've incorporated some of what we learned from you in sweet corn and pea production, other things, into our conventional system. And it really is helping with some of our mitigation of disease risk in the field and the quality of our soil. And while we, you know, they didn't make it all the way in organic, they applied it in conventional, and there was value for them in doing so. And that doesn't get tracked and monitored like organic does, but that's a win. That's a huge win. That's why we have to remember to try to work with these companies that are transitioning from conventional to organic, these bigger brands and businesses, because that's the end game, is less chemicals, healthier soil, healthier water, healthier people. So we have to work together with them.
I'm so glad you're doing this work, Matthew. I'm so thankful for your true devotion to it, the depth that it, you know, it comes from. I mean, it's truly remarkable, and I'm just so grateful you took the time to talk to us today.
Likewise, we're so grateful, and thank you for, you introduced us to a couple of resources, so I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you both for your work and for getting, you know, the message out to a much broader audience than I ever could. And I felt really honored to get the invitation, and grateful for your work. So thank you all.
Thanks for that, ladies. Another great show. And thank you to Matthew Dillon. Wow, after every podcast, I just want to go out and demand change. Let's do it. We deserve it. Right, on to our next show. We have Mike Farter joining us. He's CEO and co-founder of Manitoba Harvest Hemp Foods, and he'll be discussing how hemp has changed his life. It's going to be a good run. Right, until then, see you next time.